Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week with my co-host Stephen Bush, we talk about the Labour reshuffle, part two, and David Cameron's legacy. George joins us on the line from Westminster to talk about who might be the next Labour leader. And finally, Imad Ahmed joins us to talk about the games that restore our faith in video gaming.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast.
Well, it's been quite a quiet week for politics, I would say, Stephen, comparatively to reshuffle Geddon. But nonetheless, the Labour Party still is not, it's not entirely a happy ship, is it? There was another resignation this week.
Yes, Catherine McKinnell stepped down as Shadow Attorney General, partly to spend more time with her family, but also, she said, because she was concerned about the negative path that Labour was taking under Jeremy Corbyn. So that triggered a philosophical argument about whether or not this was a continuation of the reshuffle or a new reshuffle. George thought it was a new reshuffle. I thought it... No, George thought it was an old reshuffle. I thought it was a new reshuffle.
An epilogue to the last reshuffle, isn't it?
We did a little straw poll on the internet, and it turns out that I am in an extreme minority. I maintain that a resignation which starts another reshuffle, well, that's the beginning of the reshuffle. That's not...
I think probably that there are maybe like 6 or 7 people who care about this, and at least 1/6 of those people are in this room. So we'll move swiftly on. But one of the things that is interesting is that the dust is now settling on that reshuffle, and lots of people are kind of thinking, well, actually, Jeremy Corbyn played that better than we thought, because actually Hilary Benn was the last battle, that was Syria. Emily Thornberry and Trine, that's the next battle, right?
Yeah, the next fight will be over the nuclear deterrent, which is obviously totemic within the Labour Party. It has a significance well beyond its actual military or tactical value within Labour circles, both for and against. Of course, it opens up a fight which for him is much less asymmetrical. You know, against MPs, he has a huge mandate from members, and there's very little ways to get rid of him. Against trade union leaders, two of Labour's largest affiliated unions, the GMB and Unite, both have members whose jobs are directly linked to Trident. Len McCluskey will this week go, you know, don't you try and force this through. Although, of course, they have electorates too, and so they have to have half an eye on those. So the politics of it are more fraught. But yeah, he's in a stronger position than I think lots of people believed.
One thing I was surprised about, pleasantly surprised, I have to say, is that last week's magazine we had a piece by Joe Haynes, who used to be Harold Wilson's press secretary. And one of the things that he floated was this idea that Labour MPs had their own mandate created by, you know, 9.3 million people voting for them, which, you know, against the 250,000 people who voted from Jeremy Corbyn is a different kind of mandate. Anyway, it concluded with this, I thought at the time, kind of slightly crazy idea that the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, could elect one leader and then there could be another leader kind of for the membership. But I was surprised. We had a letter going in the magazine that's out today saying, from Frank Fields, saying that actually these are two very different jobs. Like almost this kind of like you want to have a president and a prime minister within your own party. You want to have a kind of head of state, and you also want to have somebody who is leader of the party. I wonder how much of that is just a, oh God, let's think of any way we could get rid of him, and how much of that is something that is a genuinely held principle among Labour MPs.
I think it's a, oh God, there must be some way shot of here. I mean, partly members don't want to elect someone to be their representative who's roundly ignored by MPs. They elected Corbyn to lead the Labour Party. I think it's, in some ways, the problem for Labour is you have, on the one hand, Jeremy Corbyn, who, you know, speaking candidly, I think there is very little chance he will become Prime Minister. And you look at him and you go, how could Labour have chosen this guy? Until you look at the people who are trying to oppose him and you're like, oh, right, suddenly this all makes a sort of sense. Because Labour members don't want him just to be there so they can feel good about themselves. They think he's their best possible shot. Whether they're right or wrong is entirely irrelevant. I think there was a very good piece on someone's blog, which I'm trying to nick for the Staggers at the moment, which I think sums up what Labour MPs should be saying. And they said, well, look, Jeremy Corbyn has a mandate, undeniably so. David Cameron has a mandate, but I think David Cameron's mandate is harmful for the country, and as long as he's in office, the chances of a government of the kind they want are smaller. Most Labour MPs would be better off arguing that actually they think that, yes, Jeremy Corbyn has a mandate, he undoubtedly does, but as long as he's Labour leader, the chances of a government of the kind they want are vanishingly small. You know, it's not in the nature of political parties to pack yourself up between elections and go, oh, well, the other guy has a mandate. This kind of falling around, I mean, I think it feels like Frank Field just lives now to create trouble when all of his public utterances. But
then I think, well, there's quite a, I mean, I was on the Sunday Politics this weekend and David Davis was on there and I thought that's very much the function that he performs for the Tory party. He was out talking about Europe, but on things like, you know, civil liberties as well. I don't think, I mean, I'm pro backbenchers who, I mean, obviously, as a journalist, I'm definitely pro-backbenchers who say interesting and provocative things. I guess if I were a party leader or someone in the leader's office, I would think very differently about it. But one of the things people kind of kept saying was, why aren't you talking more about the Tory splits on Europe? And I thought that was a really interesting point. And the problem about it was that the honest answer was, well, they haven't happened yet. Like, we're all waiting for them. We all sort of expect them. But at the moment, it's more low-grade grumbling than it is, you know, open knives being slipped into the back via the medium of kind of briefings to Sunday papers. That brings me to the thesis about whether or not that split will actually be that bad. But I think that's one of the two kind of unknown, well, maybe known unknowns about the next year, is how big will the Tory split in Europe be? And these warnings from George Osborne about how bad the economic outlook are they the prelude to him going, and I'm the one who's fixed it? Or are they the prelude to him going, and that's why you need to give us another 5 years because we still haven't fixed it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so in 2020, the Conservatives will not have hit their deficit reduction targets because they're fictional. Yeah, they are against all sort of economic sense and they are not achievable politically or economically. So they will be in this weird position of going, the plan is working, but it hasn't happened yet. They'll need some kind of line. There probably will be some kind of global turmoil. So it's a combination of getting his ducks in a row for 2020 and about getting his excuses in ready, because he's managed the public finances so badly, there isn't the room for a massive spending splurge of the kind that Brown and Darling embarked upon in the last recession. Interest rates are already very low. So there are lots of sort of tactical reasons for him to say all of those things. Of course, I mean, I don't think it was helpful when Gordon Brown said they'd abolish boom and bust, but I don't think that if your house gets repossessed, I don't think you care if a politician said something hubristic 10 years ago.
I think that's the mileage on the last Labour government did blah blah and Brown sold all the gold. Like every year that just fades slightly more from memory, particularly when Ed Balls is gone, when Yvette Cooper is now taking a, you know, backbench role talking about migrants. It's not like there are big figures, you know, Alistair Darling has gone, still sort of haunting around. There's not even Ed Miliband. You know, one of the things we might expected from the reshuffle was that he might come back, and that's not happened. So I think that begins to lose its sort of saliency as an attack line, really. One thing I just wanted to quickly touch on before we go is sort of Cameron's legacy. It seems strange that he's moved into, so he gave a big speech, and, you know, he's been floating this idea about he's got tuppence to redo some tower blocks and stuff like that, and the big society is kind of resurrected and zombie-like staggering back towards us again. Why on earth is he talking about his legacy and, you know, and these sort of briefings going out when it's 6 months into his second term?
Well, I think that although Number 10 hopes and believes it can pull off a yes, a remain vote in our referendum, there's an expectation that if we were to leave the European Union, he would have to go soon afterwards. And although they believe that the splits will not be as bad as some in Labour hope, if they are, then he may have to go early too. He doesn't want to go down in history as someone who attempted to cut the deficit, won a couple of referendums, and then left. So it's for him, it is about getting the legacy stuff in early. So, I mean, there are two arguments about Cameron and the Big Society. Did he ever believe it? Did he not? My instinct is he probably does because he keeps returning to it. It's just he doesn't believe in it enough.
Well, I thought Raph, this morning, our old colleague Raph Alberi, now a commentator for The Guardian, had a good... He compared him to Henry IV. So the play, the Shakespearean plays start with him saying he's going to have this crusade to the Holy Land. But it always keeps getting put off because there's other things. There's warring nobles, there's whatever. But, you know, it doesn't mean that he doesn't believe in it. It's just that he doesn't... He doesn't believe in it to the extent that he's willing to junk other things. And I think that's probably fair of Cameron. You know, he would like to have done that, but there was always something that was more pressing first. And therefore, yeah, you start to then return to it because you want to tie up your reign with a little bow that had and give it a theme rather than, you know, he was in charge when some stuff happened. It's not a very compelling story to tell, is it? But I guess we'll probably have to wrap up for now. But, well, we'll hear more from George down the line in a minute.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time for a segment I like to call Curious George, or rather George coming to us live on the line from the lobby.
Hi, Helen.
George, tell us what's happening this week.
Yes, so in this week's magazine, actually, we have a column by Dan Jarvis, one of the favourites to be the next Labour leader, which has got quite a lot of attention. He calls in it for the party to publish the official inquiry into why Labour lost, which has yet to emerge, and also opposes making policy through an online ballot of members, in this case in relation to Trident, which of course is probably the most divisive issue in Labour, and of course is one that Jarvis, as a former paratrooper, has strong opinions on.
And he's not the first one to kind of subtly manoeuvre, is he? Because you spoke to Owen Smith, who I think probably doesn't have a great deal of name recognition, but is also kind of lightly scouting out his territory. Tell us a bit more about him.
Yes. So Owen Smith, who was appointed as the Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary in Jeremy Corbyn's first reshuffle, having served as Shadow Wales Secretary under Ed Miliband, has been spoken of for a while by Labour insiders as a potential soft left candidate in a future leadership election. He's someone who supported Andy Burnham, but who quickly decided to serve under Jeremy Corbyn and avoided sort of prominent attacks or criticisms on him during the campaign and afterwards. So he's seen as quite a unifying figure. But as you say, his profile hasn't been very high. And he told me when I asked him, would you like to be Labour leader? You gave me an unusually honest and frank answer and said, look, I think if you're in this game, if you don't want to be leader, then you might question whether you're in the right field. But otherwise, you're just fibbing. And he said, of course, it would be a huge honour and privilege to do the job. And he's had quite a positive reaction to it.
I like politicians who just answer a question honestly obviously. I think Jess Phillips did something rather the same before Christmas. But that mirrors what's happening in the Tory party too, isn't it? Because particularly the Europe debate is a big opportunity and danger for Theresa May and Boris Johnson. Which way, you know, do they want to be the leader of the outers within the cabinet? We had Chris Grayling, but I don't think anyone's idea of a kind of, you know, game changer in the Europe debate. Do you think that one of them will decide that they want to lead the out campaign as, you know, to put themselves in opposition perhaps to George Osborne in the race for the next Tory leader?
At the moment, I think it's looking likely that they'll both side with In, actually, because I think the sense is that In has the advantage at the moment. I don't think either of them want to be on the losing side, but they're both clearly still making their minds up. Although Boris Johnson was reported by The Express this week to have told Conservative MPs shortly before Christmas, the problem is that I'm not an outer. And so that suggests that if he does come out for Brexit, then it will be for reasons of calculation rather than conviction. Boris is someone who actually... generally throughout his career has been far more pro-European than most assume.
Yeah, I was talking to a Tory MP who said, well, of course, Liam Fox, who you might remember from former cabinet minister fame, had a big party and Boris came and, you know, normally he just sort of swings by these things, but he actually stayed for a really long time. So he's clearly got it in his mind that he needs to do a charm offensive, whichever way he ends up falling. That's all for now, but thank you very much from George down the line from the lobby.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, we're going to talk about video games, a subject very close to my heart. And yours too, Stephen. I think you play a little bit of Football Manager, also known as Crack, basically. And Imad Ahmed, who is our Welcome Scholar, joins us as well. Imad, I wanted to start with a game that's out this week, which has been awaited for a really long time. It's called That Dragon Cancer. It's a story of a couple called Ryan and Amy Green who lost their son to childhood cancer. Mm. And they've made a game that incorporates audio recordings of his voice. They funded it quite innovatively through crowdfunding, didn't they? And you could get your kind of handprints and a message for someone that you'd loved.
Yeah, they also got some investors as well. They put all their money, all their savings into this. At one point in an interview that they gave with their Replay All, they said that they wanted to, you know, give the best memories, you know, they could of Joel, and so they wanted to put everything they could, including all the money they had.
Well, you've had special dispensation to be out of the office and play this. And I'm really interested to know, here's a good question. Did it make you cry? Because a lot of the reviews have focused on the fact that this is one of the first video games that you could say this actually is such an emotional experience that it would make you cry.
Personally, yes. It's just that I physically cannot cry. I think that's the only limitation. But yes, for the argument's sake, I would say yes, it did.
So it made you very sad, but you're not a crier.
Yeah, I'm not a crier. But yes, I think other people have said they have cried. And, you know, these are mostly middle-aged game reviewers, males, you know, who haven't really cried, I'm assuming, with most of the games they've played, such as Fallout 4 and
any other. Even when Aerith died?
No.
I'm trying to think whether or not I have. I mean, the closest I can think of is the game Heavy Rain, which was made by Quantic Dream. It was a PlayStation game a couple of years ago. And that was one of the first. There was a genre at the time. I guess it was a wave called like dad games. And the theory was that games developers had now got to the bit where instead of fixating on saving attractive women or chatting up attractive women in various forms, they were now quite interested in their relationship with their own children. And Heavy Rain begins with you losing your son in a crowded shopping mall. Like, he wanders off holding a red balloon. You can just see the red balloon. And it captures that feeling you have when you care for small children of like, oh my God, I'm in charge of basically, an idiot that will happily jump off something or walk in front of a car, and that constant tension that you feel. And then it's quick cuts to what happens after that, with a kind of grim life of single fatherdom. And that's the most emotionally engaged that I think I've ever been by a game. I don't know, Stephen, what game actually got to you?
I mean, so I'm a crier. I cry at films, novels, and games. So I think games which have made me cry. Final Fantasy X? The ending of Final Fantasy X?
Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that I haven't played any Final Fantasies. I mean, a rhetorical device, if you will.
I was
going
to say spoiler alert, but the game's a decade old, so, you know. There's a bit at the end when the main character is fading away and she tries, and the other main character tries to run in him and hug him, and she runs right through him, and it's just very painful and very sad. Yeah, I think both Final Fantasy's kind of taken a turn for the worse, but both Final Fantasies 9 and 10 had some really sort of heart-rending, emotionally involving moments. Heavy Rain, The Last Express, which was a point-and-click game, which occurs in real time and is now on the iPad. I found that very affecting. Ico.
So the premise of you always having to hold the hand of the girl was, I think that was that kind of thing of giving you an emotional connection to someone. One of the games that I actually felt a genuine emotional connection with was 80 Days, which was a little iOS game that was out last year, which was basically a kind of feminist post-colonialist retelling of Phineas Fogg's journey, which I know probably sounds the most New Statesman thing you've ever heard, but was genuinely enjoyable in a kind of, had a sense of exploration about it that I really loved. And it was just, it had a great little art style and it had funny characters that you really kind of, you felt in love. But I'm really interested in this email because I don't know whether or not it's my age. I don't know, it's like that thing where like journalists about my age write a piece about how they've left London and London's over, and it turns out it's just because they don't want to live in a tiny flat and go to raves anymore. They want to, eat croissants by the seafront. I wonder if this is my problem. This is why I wonder if I'm falling out of games because I'm aging out of them, or whether or not last year's games were a bit sequel-y.
Yeah, there are too many sequels, I think. I personally went ahead and chose games that were very original for my best of year list. And I think there are ways in which original stories can be told through games. I think there is, yes, maybe a demographic shift now that many people who used to play older consoles are now developers and maybe feeding in their own experiences of fatherhood. Well, let's say parented, but mostly fatherhood.
But it really was dad games, because it was Bioshock Infinite, which was very much you're in the role of a father. The Last of Us, which is all about, you know, this kind of father-like bond. They weren't. I can't think of a game where you play a mum. I'd be really interested if any of our listeners.
It depends if you play as a woman in Fallout 4.
That's true. That is true, actually. Yeah, I do play as a very kick-ass woman in Fallout 4. So that's. But there's nothing. I don't know. There's nothing because that's written as a gender-neutral character. I guess it's not a specific experience in the same way. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point about those like Mass Effect, where you can choose to play as a male or a female. What does that do? Does that make it? You know, does it take something away from not writing a specific experience?
I think the difference. I think with Fallout, the plot is quite sparse. Whereas, I mean, I think I'm always surprised when people tell me they've only ever played Mass Effect as a man, because it's not as satisfying.
But also you get the much better voice actor. Yeah. I mean, you get the internationally renowned voice actor if you play a woman. And yet, yeah, 7 out of 10 players played as a man.
I can't believe that. I don't think I would have played the second one if I'd been playing. But I started it with the man, put it down. A friend of mine said, oh, try again with the woman. Because I was just like, oh, it's this stereotypical kind of, I'm a spaceman and I'm angry. And then with the woman, it's just somehow much better. I think I probably cried at the end of Mass Effect 3. I mean, because Mass Effect 3 was an odd example of one where the game experience was awful. The end of the plot was quite disappointing. But because it was a sequel, it had already acquired quite a lot of emotional weight.
Yeah, I haven't cried at any Mass Effect. I liked them. In the second one, I had a lot more time for Garrus. You know, you're wasted, roguish. That's who I romanced in the second one. I was Liara in the first one, Garrus in the second one.
How could you not have been sad if you romance Garrus and then you had in the third bit when she's like, and he's like, you know, and he's like, you know, if I die, and she's like, you know, if I die, you know, like, you're never alone. That bit choked me up. That was
But that's why you play it on easy, so you make sure that everyone survives.
Yeah, you play for the story. But the problem with Mass Effect was it was a great story. It was this whole Star Wars equivalent in the first game, but then it slowly became an action series, unfortunately. I think that's why it did slowly drift off, and like you said, I think by the third game people just gave up.
So let's be edutainment. Let's give some recommendations of good games that do something a bit different, that give you hope about video games as a genre.
I think what you're just talking about, you know, just gender, I think Life is Strange is a perfect example. You know, you play as an 18-year-old girl, and I think when I was playing it, Not even for a second did I think, oh, this is unusual. I need to think differently in my interactions, because it is basically like an interactive movie similar to Heavy Rain. I think that's a perfect example of how games have shifted and have come along to cater for everyone, not just the stereotypical teenage male.
Gamer bro. Yeah, I think I would pick Her Story, which I played over Christmas, which is I think it's like about a fiver on Steam. And it is just a series of police interview tapes, and they cut out the interview, and it's only the woman answering. And the way that you do it is you have to try and solve what you think has happened by typing in search terms into a box, and then it will return the clips of her that are caught from that. And from that, you have to piece together a story. And it's really lo-fi. I mean, you could have made it with a video camera and relatively, you know, low-level coding knowledge, but the thought that's gone into how do I make a patchwork of a story, and so that, you know, you do this simple thing that everybody does probably, you know, several times a day, which is type a word into a search box, and how do you turn that into an active experience where you're learning and you're piecing together stories. And also I reviewed it with Saturday Review, and Satnam Sangera compared it to B.S. Johnson's The Unfortunates, which is famously this book in a box. And it had that same feeling of how you can feel, like almost feel your brain struggling to create a linear story out of fragments. And that's quite a satisfying process, I thought. Stephen, have you played anything that's actually made you, given you hope for video games? And don't say Championship Manager.
The dispiriting thing is I realise how much, because I don't have a new console yet, then the game I've been replaying and enjoying a great deal is Fallout New Vegas, which I think is probably my favourite of the Fallouts. But I think weirdly, despite the fact that I think there is a big problem with AAA gaming and the fact that the bar to new entrants is so hard that you effectively have a dysfunctional market where there's no innovation. But I did think Fallout 4 was quite an exciting step forward in terms of the capabilities of an open world game.
It did look a lot better, didn't it? I mean, you didn't have that weird thing where people fix you with their kind of like dead-eyed gaze and just stare directly at you and mouth lines of dialogue. There was some animation. But it was one of those things, I don't know if you felt, have you played Skyrim?
Yeah.
I sort of felt like I was enjoying that in spite of the game. All the bits of it I enjoy were just having a walk, largely. I remember a great bit in Skyrim where I just found a lovely waterfall. It was really nice. Yeah. Obviously, then I immediately got killed by like a bear or something 5 minutes later. Emad, so Life is Strange is available on which platforms?
Xbox 360, Xbone, PS3, PS4, and PC. Yes, I did just say that.
You did say Xbone. Yeah. Okay, that happened. And for our listeners this week, if you've got recommendations for off-the-beaten-track games, we are very much open. We have. Well, we can't spend all day talking about the Labour reshuffle. We have to have some fun too. So do tweet us with your suggestions.
And now it's time for Stephen Bush's Joke of the Week. How many Conservative MPs does it take to change a light bulb? All of them. George Osborne to screw it up, and all of the others to tell him what a good job he's doing in the House of Commons.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.